Welcome, welcome to the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. Tune in to hear leaders in neurology sound off on topics that impact your clinical practice. I'm your host, Marco Meglio, editor with Neurology Live. In this episode, we sat down with Phil Jochelson, the therapeutic head for clinical development neuroscience at Jazz Pharmaceuticals, who discussed the Phase 4 Xylo study, a trial assessing the effect of switching from high to low sodium oxybate on blood pressure in patients with narcolepsy. Jochelson gave an overview of the study and why it's unique, as well as the significance of observing blood pressure and what it means for patients. Furthermore, he provided insight on the growth in the knowledge profile of low sodium oxybate and how this study will help clinicians who treat those with narcolepsy. Let's dive in.
Thank you, Marco. Let me start with perhaps the background and the impetus for this study. It's been well described, the relationship between high sodium and cardiovascular morbidity, specifically around hypertension, which can then result in additional cardiovascular adverse events that can be major in many, many cases. So there are many societies and medical associations, American Heart Association, American Cardiology, even FDA have come out and have sodium lowering initiatives, and not just for patients with existing hypertension, but really for all patients. And there's been a lot of movement in this area about reducing dietary sodium. So this is important in the context of the narcolepsy patient population, because this is an at-risk population for cardiovascular morbidity. They have high BMI, they commonly have hypertension, and it's been sort of emerging data that has shown that this is an at-risk population. So Xyrem, which is one of the treatments that Jazz has had for many years, is approved by FDA for the treatment of narcolepsy, both the cataplexy symptoms and the excessive daytime sleepiness, has a very high sodium burden associated with that. And it's actually in the label the high sodium load that is there. So that background sort of served as an impetus. Can we still provide the benefit of oxybate, but without that sodium load, the excessive sodium load? Which is pretty high with Xyrem. It's about, if you up it, the 9 grams can be about one, the 9 gram dose gives about 1.6 grams of sodium, or 1600 milligrams. I don't know what the exact conversion is, but that could be eight, depending on the size of your bag of chips, about 8 to 10 bags of chips, potato chips a day, which is quite significant. So it ranges from the effective approved doses. The salt equivalent would be somewhere between 1,100 and 1,600 milligrams a day, 1.1 to 1.6 grams a day of excess sodium that you clearly, nobody needs that. It's been well shown not to be, healthy for you. So that serves the impetus for the company to develop this low sodium version of oxybate, which is now approved and is Xywav. We thought, in addition to getting it approved, that we should actually also be looking at whether this low sodium version actually translates into a lower blood pressure effect. So hence the Xylo study, where we'll be taking patients who are on the high sodium version of the of oxybate and allowing them to transition to the low sodium version, which is Xywav, and to measure the blood pressure changes that make the switch from the high to the low sodium load, which we believe is a better product for our patients.
So talk a little bit about who would be enrolled into this type of trial, and if there's any sort of caveats in terms of inclusion, exclusion, are there certain things that you guys would exclude from the study? And just talk a little bit about some of the patient demographics of who would make up this trial.
So these would be patients with diagnosed narcolepsy, either, type 1 or type 2. The type 1 are patients who have cataplexy as well as excessive daytime sleepiness, and the type 2 do not have the cataplexy, but do have the excessive daytime sleepiness and other manifestations of the narcolepsy, the disease of narcolepsy. So as long as you have that diagnosis, which is frequently a clinical diagnosis, and you have a you're on 6 to 9 grams of the high sodium product, because those are the people who are carrying that or have that high sodium burden. And also a blood pressure of greater than 130 millimeters of mercury, because 130 millimeters of mercury is a good cutoff, because you're considered uncontrolled if you're above 130. If you go back and look at the American Heart Association hypertension guidelines, they want patients, certainly under 130, it would be considered uncontrolled, especially if they were on meds. So that's the population that we initially have focused on within this study. And then we also don't want them to have too high a blood pressure to be completely treatment resistant. So currently have a limit of, I think, 145 millimeters of mercury on the upper end. But other than that, it's pretty real world, representative of the population who will be treated with Xywav or Xyrem. And we've kept it pretty broad other than that, other than those sort of I think which are key baseline characteristics and the type of patient that we'd like to enroll in that study.
We're going to take a quick break from our conversation with Phil to keep you up to date on the latest developments in neurology. Welcome to the Neurology News Minute. Here's what you may have missed since our last episode. First, on July 26th, Eisai announced that the European Medicines Agency adopted a negative opinion for the approval of lecanemab as a treatment for patients with early-stage Alzheimer's disease. Lecanemab, a humanized IgG1 monoclonal antibody directed against aggregated soluble and insoluble forms of amyloid beta, gained traditional approval in the U.S. in July 2023, marketed under the name Leqembi. It is also approved in Japan, China, South Korea, Hong Kong, and Israel for the treatment of mild cognitive impairment due to AD and mild AD dementia. Days later, at the 2024 Alzheimer's Association International Conference, data from a Phase 2b study showed that treatment with liraglutide, a GLP-1 receptor agonist, has neuroprotective effects against Alzheimer's disease dementia. Overall, those on active treatment had an 18% slower decline in cognitive function at 1 year compared with placebo. The study also revealed changes on secondary endpoints of clinical and cognitive measures and statistically significant benefits on brain volume. And finally, on August 7th, the FDA approved Amneal Pharmaceuticals agent IPX-203, an oral formulation of carbidopa-levodopa extended-release capsules as a treatment for patients with Parkinson's disease. Marketed as Cresant, the therapy is an oral formulation CDLD which includes immediate-release granules as well as extended-release pellets. For more information about these stories, head to neurologylive.com or you can check out the corresponding link in the show notes. And now, back to our conversation with Phil.
I think that's beneficial. You know, we talk a lot with a lot of different people about how sometimes clinical trial findings may not translate as well to real world data and how there may be kind of a discrepancy, but it's encouraging to see that you guys kind of don't have too many parameters per se, and that we're gathering a sort of quote unquote, basically real world data, essentially in a controlled trial of sorts. So I'm curious, Phil, talk a little bit about some of the endpoints of the study and how would you guys characterize what a successful study would look like per se?
Yeah, so, and just to remind you, the study is still ongoing and enrolling. It's not completed yet. And I think we presented the poster around the methodology and the design at APSS, the sleep meeting, just a few weeks back. Yeah, so the key thing here is measuring blood pressure using ambulatory blood pressure monitoring, and what that is, as you probably know, is patients carry this and have it hooked up to them for 24 hours in a day. Like so, you do it at the beginning of the study, before they switch treatment, and then at the end of the study when they've been on the lower sodium. So you can actually see that. So it's a 24-hour assessment that measures both daytime blood pressure as well as nighttime blood pressure, and is sort of, I would say, the state-of-the-art way to evaluate blood pressure, because when you go to your doctor and they measure your blood pressure in the office, it's sort of a snapshot in time. It's not re and it's a snapshot in time when you're in the doctor's office. So while we use that as a screening tool as practitioners, it really doesn't always give you an accurate and comprehensive assessment of what the patient's blood pressure would be in their home environment or at nighttime, which is important for this patient population too. So I think from that point of view, it's a very accurate and well a very considered a gold standard measure of blood pressure when you're doing blood pressure studies as your primary endpoint, which is going to be looking at the reduction in blood pressure. I don't think we've I think we talked a little bit about in the poster about what the actual effects that we are sort of planning or hoping to see within that study. I just want to just check them, make sure that I'm not talking out on that it's in public domain. Yeah, so I think we provided there the power for the study. We did provide the statistical sort of assumptions that went into it, and we're targeting a systolic blood pressure reduction over the a mean systolic blood pressure over 24 hours of 3.5 millimeter reduction, and the standard deviation of 8 millimeters of mercury from baseline to the end of treatment. And that may sound relatively small to some people. Well, why is that important? Why did you pick that 3 millimeter or 3.5 millimeter? That has been the standard that has been shown well in the literature. When you go look at Framingham models and you look at patients that are at cardiovascular risk, even modest changes in mean blood pressure, actually, when you look at their 10-year outcome data on MACE, it has been associated with significant increases in major adverse cardiovascular events in the moderate to high-risk cardiovascular population. So it seems small in terms of the mean increase, but it actually has profound effects across time. And then obviously there's some patients that are contributing to that that are having substantial increases from a high sodium load, or from there may be other drugs that increase blood pressure as well. So if you go look at FDA historically, drugs that have blood pressure increases, so if you look at amphetamines or you look at other maybe some other weight promoting agents, when they've had a greater than 2 or 3 millimeter mercury increase in ambulatory blood pressure, there's even a testosterone product that actually has that too, and other areas where that is seen. They've usually had that in the warnings and precautions section of the label, and in some cases have received a black box warning, depending on the patient population of whether they're at risk as well. So that's sort of the, I won't call it the official regulatory threshold of concern, but that's what we have seen. And there's a press of guidance that FDA has put out for how to evaluate drugs that have blood pressure effects, and what are the thresholds that would be that you're trying to sort of rule out in your drug development program for drugs that have increases in blood pressure. And it's also thought to be a bidirectional relationship. So obviously, Xyrem, we believe that sodium load has the potential to increase your blood pressure, when taken chronically over time, keeping in mind it's a lifelong disease with a, where that sodium burden will be tremendous over the lifetime of a patient. But we, in this case, as I said, we're trying to show the reduction in blood pressure, and it is considered a bidirectional relationship, right? In terms of its effect on major adverse cardiovascular events. So we think we're excited, of course, to see the outcome of that study, and there is a an interim analysis. I think that is planned at a certain number of patients. We've shared that and within the APSS poster, and but obviously we also may continue that through to the final sample size if needed. So we may have an early data readout. That's possible.
Well, I think it's cool that you guys are, obviously taking into account some of the thresholds and things that you're using from historical data, input from what the FDA and some of these other organizations have kind of, suggested, I guess, per se. So that's encouraging for sure. Phil, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day. The last question that I have for you, sorry, there's something stuck in my nose. The last question that I have for you is, obviously, low sodium oxybate has been on the market for a few years now, and we're starting to, get a little bit more into the clinical space, I guess, per se. But, since its approval, how would you assess, from a clinician testing perspective, the knowledge that we've gained about this drug and how we can utilize it even more effectively? Just are there certain things that we've started to understand a little bit more since it's kind of come into the market?
Well, a couple of things that I would say is a lot of clinicians sort of don't necessarily pay attention to this. So I think there's an educational component about the sodium load and the cardiovascular risk around that. In addition, not all the clinicians were aware that the narcolepsy patient population are an at-risk group. There are some who are very aware and some who are less aware. So educating people around, the combination of those two things is really, really important, and it's resonated very well because it makes a lot of sense to clinicians. Especially when you think about, many of these societies that I talked about, including FDA, have talked about, trying to keep dietary sodium below 2,000 milligrams a day, and here you've got a medicine that historically was giving 1,600 milligrams a day. So this is a significant advance for, for this patient population. There's also been a important data that's emerging, from claims databases that is showing when you compare patients, in patients who actually start Xyrem, and you follow them up and you look at these claims databases, there's a twofold increase in the risk of them developing new onset hypertension or requiring antihypertensive medication. So there's that, now the evidence is all starting to come together from a variety of different domains. And then I would also say that we didn't talk too much about idiopathic hypersomnia. We, this is Xywav is also approved for idiopathic hypersomnia. It's the only drug approved in the US for that. And it's got some robust efficacy as well within that patient population on multiple of the symptoms, and we've got a broad indication for that, not just for the treatment of EDS, but we actually got for the treatment of idiopathic hypersomnia broadly because of its impact on multiple domains of the disease that was measured through the idiopathic hypersomnia severity scale. And interestingly, this low sodium version is going to also be a not only because of the efficacy benefit, but this is also a population that has a lot of cardiovascular comorbidity, and there's new emerging data around that. And there was actually a survey results that we presented at APSS that showed that cardiovascular comorbidity is actually high up in the comorbidity list for this patient population. So I think just all in all, we're excited about the opportunity to bring this low sodium option to a population that really would benefit from the low sodium option, from a safety point of view, but also while maintaining the efficacy of the older version, or the original version of the drug, which was Xyrem.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Neurology Live Mind Moments podcast. To support the show, be sure to rate, review, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, for more neurology news and expert-driven content, visit neurologylive.com.